This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 3rd of March. US stocks have fallen after President Trump confirmed that his tariffs on goods from Mexico and Canada would be coming into effect at midnight. We get reaction from the Premier of the Canadian province of British Columbia. After Keir Starmer tells MPs that the United States will always be indispensable, the former Defence Secretary Grant Shapps tells us that Europeans should have the confidence to defend themselves alone. Also, the latest on the car attack in the German city of Mannheim. We remember the Scottish artist Jack Vetriano, and we'll ask whether the success of the film Anora at the Oscars could have a positive impact on sex workers. You're listening to The World Tonight with James Kamara-Sami. Whether on trade or security, President Trump's foreign policy continues to reshape the world. In the past hour, he signed an order for tariffs on goods from China to be increased to 20%, and he's confirmed that new tariffs or import taxes of 25% on Canadian and Mexican products will come into force in the next few hours. That is news which has caused US stocks to tumble. And 3 days after that Oval Office encounter with President Zelensky, there has been more criticism of the Ukrainian leader. On his Truth Social platform, Mr. Trump posted that the Ukrainian leader saying the end of the war with Russia was very, very far away was the worst statement that could have been made, and that America will not put up with it for much longer. Speaking in the White House this evening, he was asked whether that meant he was rethinking military aid to Ukraine.
President Zelensky supposedly made a statement today in AP. I'm not a big fan of AP, so maybe it was an incorrect statement, but he said he thinks the war's going to go on for a long time. And he better not be right about that. That's all I'm saying.
Well, Mr. Trump was also asked what it would take for President Zelensky to get another invitation to the White House to sign the minerals deal.
Well, I just think he should be more appreciative, because this country has stuck with them through thick and thin. We've given them much more than Europe, and Europe should have given more than us, because, as you know, that's right there. That's the border. This country really was like the fence on the border. It was very important to Europe. And I'm not knocking Europe. I'm saying that they were a lot smarter than Joe Biden, because Joe Biden didn't have a clue. He just gave money hand over fist.
Of course, it hasn't just been Europeans involved in this weekend's flurry of diplomatic activity. A day after he hosted President Zelensky at Sandringham, the King today welcomed another leader who's found himself on the wrong side of Donald Trump, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. President Trump has referred to him as Governor Trudeau as part of his threats to make Canada America's 51st state. And then there are those tariffs. Canada and Mexico negotiated a last-minute reprieve a month ago, and Mr. Trump was asked tonight whether that could happen again.
On the tariffs, is there any room left for Canada and Mexico to make a deal before midnight, and should we expect those Chinese tariffs, the extra 10%, to take effect
tomorrow? No room left for Mexico or for Canada. No, the tariffs, they're all set. They go into effect tomorrow.
In a moment, we'll hear from the Premier of British Columbia in Canada. But first, let's speak to the BBC's North America editor, Sarah Smith. Sarah, let's start with Ukraine, because President Trump seemed to suggest the minerals deal could be salvaged, but no direct answer to those reports that he's considering cutting off military aid to Ukraine. What more do we know about what the White House is thinking when it comes to Ukraine at the moment?
Well, I think it's clearly on the table. There have been some reports that there will be a meeting of Donald Trump's national security advisers and the president himself at some point this afternoon to look at that. And he could have chosen to rule that out. It would have been very easy for him in that press conference to say, we have no intention of cutting off military aid at this point. But he chose to dodge that question really quite deliberately instead of ruling it out, because he is, you know, you can sense just how annoyed he is with President Zelensky. And for a couple of reasons, because he doesn't seem to agree with President Trump about how quickly this war can be finished. And there is a lot of people here in Washington, people very close to Donald Trump, saying he's clearly just not ready to make peace. He's not ready to begin these talks. And that's very, very frustrating for the American president, who is clearly in quite a hurry to try and end this war. And the other thing that's become very apparent from Donald Trump is that he is worried it is because of American support, because of American military aid, that President Zelensky and Ukraine are able to drag their feet, that they are using America's backing to stall going into the peace talks. And that is clearly something that Donald Trump will not countenance for much longer. So that's why I think we have to assume it is very much on the cards that they will be at the very least discussing the possibility of reducing or cutting off the aid that they send to Ukraine.
Well, there has been a bit of a ceasefire when it came to the tariffs, but Donald Trump made clear that the trade war is very much on, that the Canadians and the Mexicans are going to get their 25% tariffs on all goods, that the Chinese getting increased tariffs on theirs. What's the reaction been to all of this inside America?
Yeah, well, the markets did not like that at all. We saw significant falls in stock prices this afternoon after Donald Trump very clearly said that was nothing that Canada or Mexico could do to avoid these tariffs now, that it was too late. They were being imposed tomorrow, come what may. And we saw a drop in the value of stocks. And of course, the other thing that many people have predicted will happen once you put these large tariffs on is that prices will rise for consumers inside the United States, that the cost of these tariffs will be passed on to the products consumers are buying, and that that could put inflation up. And given that this is a president who promised he would start reducing prices and reducing inflation on day one, and he hasn't been able to do it yet, that could significantly harm him with some of his voter base if they don't get what they want at the cash register, if they don't see those prices falling, and if it is blamed on his tariffs.
Sarah, many thanks. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, there. Well, I've been speaking about the tariffs and security with David Eby, who's the premier of the Canadian province of British Columbia. It's located in the far west of Canada, and it exports lumber, aluminium, oil and gas, and various high-tech services to the United States. And I asked him what about the mood was like in Canada on the eve of those tariffs being imposed.
There are two things happening right now in Canada. One is just a remarkable level of patriotism and solidarity among Canadians to work together against the tariff threat. The other is huge uncertainty. I mean, we've been up against this deadline before. The president changed his mind, and it's hard not to suspect that this is all part of the strategy, this uncertainty to undermine investment in our country and to hurt our economy without actually imposing the tariffs.
So what kind of impact has it had?
In practical terms, and some of it's a bit paradoxical, you know, we've seen orders increase for certain things as traders try to get critical minerals and metals from British Columbia, from Canada, into warehouses and sold before tariffs come into place. So companies are reporting increases in sales. In other areas, it's been quite harmful where companies had planned expansions. Uncertain is the right word.
Because when it comes to lumber, British Columbia exports a lot to the United States, doesn't it? And there is a suggestion of another tax on top of this tariff, specifically on lumber. What kind of impact would that have on your province?
There's already a softwood lumber tariff on products going into the United States that ranges for the company from 11 to 15%. And then there's a proposal, of course, of the 25% across the board tariff, which puts you in the neighborhood of 40%. And then the president has now announced a lumber dumping investigation, which I think we can all predict what the outcome will be, which will be an additional tariff. So all of a sudden, we're looking at potential tariffs on Canadian timber coming to the U.S. market of 50% or more. And this at a time when Americans are doing significant rebuilding in L.A. and North Carolina following flooding and fire, and they don't have the capacity in the U.S. to produce this wood. So it means they're going to be paying significantly more for that housing. It's going to inflate costs for Americans.
Do those arguments work at all? Presumably those are the ones that are being made behind the scenes.
Yeah, those are the arguments that many American companies are making to the president, especially if you use aluminum or you use wood or you use electricity or you use natural gas from Canada. The understanding that we have, having met with a number of Republicans in Washington, D.C., is that the president is prepared to absorb political pain for what he sees as a longer-term goal. Whether that's to make Canada the 51st state, which, by the way, will never happen, or to extract concessions from Canada that will be economically damaging to our country.
You say it will never happen, but are you convinced that that is the goal, that when President Trump talks about Canada as the 51st state, that is his aim?
Yeah, we take them deadly seriously. The conversations we've had behind the scenes with Republicans have not alleviated any of the concern that we would have that maybe he's just joking around or trolling our prime minister or whatever you might think. For us, we do see these threats as existential, and it's really brought Canadians together in a way that we haven't seen in a long, long time, certainly in my memory.
And of course, your prime minister has been over here in London. He was at the meeting of European and other heads of government to talk about the way forward in Ukraine. Do you see, as a result of what's happened, that Canada is going to get closer to Europe, to the European Union, to the UK and other European countries?
The short answer is yes. The president is threatening countries all around the world with tariffs and other bizarre behavior, especially targeting longtime allies. I certainly hope that Prime Minister Trudeau has some success deepening our ties with the EU, with the UK. It will absolutely take a coalition of the willing working together to push back on some of these things. At the same time, I also wish Prime Minister Starmer the best of luck with his goal of trying to be a bridge to Europe.
So you were happy with what you saw when Keir Starmer visited the Oval Office?
Well, I understood what he was doing because we did the same thing. You know, it's vital to try to talk to the president, to talk to his team around him, to help them understand the deep ties and the consequences of kicking at the foundations of these relationships. And I also recognize that it's likely that the UK will find itself in a very similar position that Canada does, facing either threats around military cooperation or threats around tariffs. And when and if that happens, I just want to reassure BBC listeners, at least, and everyone in the UK, that Canada will, of course, stand with our longtime allies in the UK, and we certainly hope you'll stand with us.
So Canada tried it, but is still facing these tariffs. You think Britain will be any more successful in staving them off?
I think everyone's got to try everything that they can. I think if it takes the president meeting with the king, I think that's great news. I watched that meeting with Mr. Zelensky in the Oval Office. And anyone who can interrupt what looks to me like an incredibly troubling direction for the world, I welcome that. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't pan out, let's stick together and let's work together to respond and protect what we value more than anything.
A troubling direction for the world. Where do you see this going?
The concern I think that many of us share is that we're transitioning from a world where there is a due process and there are rules and there are laws that everybody follows to a world where might makes right. And if it's possible to invade a peaceful neighbor like Russia did with Ukraine and face no consequences, I think that's very troubling because there are many powerful countries in the world and there are many neighbors that are not. And Canada is one in that situation. You know, we have depended on our ally, the United States, for many, many generations. We've been friends and colleagues. We have family on both sides of the border. And yet we're facing some of the most severe threats from this administration economically, as well as a threat to our sovereignty.
Are you saying that you see parallels with Russia, Ukraine? Obviously, the context is different, but
it's a paradox. You know, at the person-to-person relationship level, we're friends, we're colleagues, we're business partners with Americans. But at the political level with the president, I mean, we haven't faced a threat to our sovereignty from the United States for, I mean, more than 100 years. It's profoundly disturbing to Canadians and worrying and causes us anxiety about things that we thought were never going to be an issue.
That was David Eby, the Premier of the Canadian province of British Columbia.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
That was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Sir Keir Starmer briefed MPs today on Saturday's meetings at Lancaster House and the formation with France of a coalition of the willing to enforce any peace deal in Ukraine. But while the flurry of diplomatic activity was a reaction to the possibility of the United States taking a more backseat role when it comes to European security, the Prime Minister said that this was not an alternative to close transatlantic ties.
We must strengthen our relationship with America. For our security, for our technology, for our trade and investment. They are and always will be indispensable. And we will never choose between either side of the Atlantic. In fact, Mr. Speaker, if anything, the past week has shown that that idea is totally unserious.
Grant Shapps was the Conservative Defence Secretary from 2023 to 2024, and I asked him what he thought of the diplomatic tightrope that Keir Starmer was attempting to walk.
He's playing a very, very tricky hand pretty well at the moment, but we're living in truly unprecedented times when it comes to the United States, and that makes it difficult.
And certainly tonight, Donald Trump giving no sense that he is in any way warming to President Zelensky, saying that his comments about the war with Russia not being over for a very, very long time was the worst thing he could have said. I mean, hinting perhaps that America might be rethinking military aid, although he didn't come down on that either way when he was asked at the news conference tonight. But what is your view of where this is heading?
The warning signs have been around for a long time. President after president has been very clear that Europe needs to spend money to defend itself. Europe collectively has failed to do that. And in a sense, we're paying the price of our European borders potentially being rewritten by a country which isn't even on our continent. And that should concern us all.
You've been very strong in your criticism of what Donald Trump is doing. You said on X, Ukraine now faces dual threats, Russian aggression from the East and opportunistic asset grabbing from the West. Is Donald Trump someone that we in this country can trust to have our backs? Because the Prime Minister seems to suggest, or does suggest, that he is and that we have to strengthen our relationship with the United States. But what's your view?
The Prime Minister, again, is saying the right thing there, and our defence relationship is unbelievably close. I mean, much closer than most people realise, much closer than I would realise until I was Defence Secretary, in all sorts of ways that we can't go into. But I can be a lot more blunt than somebody who is in office can be about this whole thing. This is like Putin's dream coming true. A president in the White House who, rather than defending freedom and liberty, he's siding with a dictator who's invaded a free and democratic country. I mean, you've got to stop and think about this. America, who pride themselves on being the defender of the free and home of the free, are shrinking from the world. They're backing a dictator in Putin and refusing to support a democratic country in Europe. I mean, it is pretty horrific stuff. And we should be prepared to step up European-wise to this.
Well, do you think it's too late to salvage the relationship with Donald Trump and President Zelensky?
Not necessarily. If you look at the way that President Trump works, his MO is often to fall out and then back in with people. He often falls in love with people and then out with them. And he can go in either direction. So I don't think it is necessarily all over.
But the question then is, can we do this alone? Can Europe and Canada, if need be the ones who defend Ukraine?
I actually believe we can. And I haven't heard this being said elsewhere. And I hope that people will accept that I know something about this, given the role that I've had and the conversations I've had previously across Europe. Somehow, Europe has managed to get itself into this extraordinary position where Europe itself is saying, oh, we can't do it on our own. We need America. It's impossible without them. I genuinely think we have to stop ourselves from continuously going back to, is what we want to do on our continent acceptable to a country 3,000 miles away? I think we just have to wean ourselves off that we have to somehow ask permission from the United States before doing these things. We are much more powerful collectively than we are giving ourselves credit. We lack the leadership. And I think that's where countries like Britain and perhaps France, Germany, Poland can really step up at this point in time. And let's actually deal with this ourselves rather than, as Trump himself points out today, rather pathetically, checking in to see if it's all okay with America.
But there would be consequences then. If America did cut military aid, you say Europe could cope, but what would the impact be?
The immediate impact, and this is our great European decision, I suppose, is do we actually think it's worth the candle? Do we as the European continent think that it is worth, for example, all spending around 3% in pretty quick order on the defence of Europe? Then if we just don't think it's worth that, then sure, we can have our borders rewritten by a dictator and by an unsympathetic White House.
Former Conservative Defence Secretary Grant Shapps. And coming up later, the journalist question, which some say kicked off that extraordinary spat between Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House on Friday.
Why don't you wear a suit? Why don't you wear a suit? You're the highest level in this country's office, and you refuse to wear a suit. Just want to see if you do own a suit?
Well, examine the change to which reporters get access to the White House and what it means for America. That is the now familiar sound of emergency services in Germany responding to reports of a car being driven into a crowd of people. The location on this occasion, the southwestern city of Mannheim. Two people have been killed, 10 others injured, 4 of them seriously, we understand. Let's get the latest from the BBC's Bethany Bell, who's in Mannheim. So, Bethany, bring us up to date. What do we know about the attack and the perpetrator?
Well, I'm standing very close to where the attack happened, which was right in the pedestrian centre of Mannheim, a big shopping centre where lots of people were out today in the sunshine when a car drove right through them. And what the authorities are saying is that they don't believe that there was a political or a religious motive to this attack. They believe that the suspect, who is a 40-year-old German man, appears to have been mentally ill. They say that after the attack, he pulled out a gun and shot himself in the mouth. He was then taken to hospital, where he is said to be in a stable condition. But this is something which has caused enormous shock here. It was a time of heightened security in Germany because this is carnival season. This is when there are a lot of parades through towns, and there had been a big parade in Mannheim itself the day before. But the police say they don't believe the attack had anything specifically to do with carnival itself, but they do believe it was deliberate, and there has been condemnation from Germany's leaders.
Bethany, many thanks for that. Bethany Bell with that update on the latest from Mannheim. Now, Jack Vetriano, the Scottish artist who's died at the age of 73, was never a favourite of the art world, but the punters loved him. His most famous painting, The Singing Butler, depicts a maid and a butler holding umbrellas over a couple who are dancing on a storm-swept beach. It was sold back in 2004 for £750,000 and was later reimagined by Banksy. Jack Nicholson and Alex Ferguson, just two of the famous fans of a self-taught painter who came from humble beginnings. He had plenty of international exhibitions, but certainly in the early part of his career, his work was ignored by the big public galleries. Speaking on Desert Island Discs, in the year when The Singing Butler was sold, Jack Vetriano was critical of those who ran them.
I mean, if they want people to go into those galleries, why don't they put something in that they want to bloody see? I'll be surprised, and this isn't some kind of egotistical bluff, I'll be surprised if my work isn't around in a few hundred years. You know, they're just so horrified that I get the kind of publicity I get and that I earn the kind of money I earn.
Well, we are joined live by the art critic Estelle Lovett now to discuss his legacy. Estelle, good evening, first of all. And why is it, do you think, that Jack Vetriano's work wasn't embraced by the wider art community?
I think there's a snobbery in the art world that's really uncalled for. I think that because he used books of photographs of figures to copy figures from rather than drawing from life, I think they didn't actually notice how magnificent, wonderful and talented he was, how he sort of snuck in relevance to art history from the Impressionists and to Sargent and to all the great masters, and he made the art world his own. You know, they sort of said, well, is he just sort of a dim artist, slightly brainless, who creates this sort of soft porn fantasy? And they were totally missing everything that he stood for.
I mentioned the modest upbringing. Was that also part of it, do you think?
Oh, you know, being raised in poverty, sharing a bed with his brother, and wearing hand-me-down clothes, being sent out to deliver the papers and milk at 10 years of age, cleaning windows, picking potatoes, leaving school at 15, you know, going in to a mining career, and also to make up extra money being a bingo caller. You know, he was a self-taught artist. He wasn't really what we consider an artistic genius to as a start in life. But he used to go and he used to sit in the public galleries in Scotland, so much so that he was merely copying and transcribing the masterpieces there. But he sat there for such a long time that they actually thought that he was there and perhaps was going to steal some of them.
Well, you're clearly a fan, and he had some famous fans. I mentioned a couple of them, Jack Nicholson, Alex Ferguson, Tim Rice, Robbie Coltrane. What is it then that attracts you and his fans to his work?
He just captured life. He captured the isolation of life. He captured, you know, in the same way that Edward Hopper did it for the American realists. Whilst they have Hopper, we have Jack Vetriano. And he was an introspective artist who looked at everyday life and filled it with quiet moments of suggestion, quiet moments of neo-realism, visual poetry that made you actually want to be in one of his canvases. He may not have been the most intellectual of artists, but I still, you know, question that as well, because he had an emotional response. He had a feel-good harmony in a frame. He didn't change the course of art history, but oh my goodness, he was pitch perfect in inspiring escapism.
Feel good harmony in a frame. That's a pretty pitch perfect analysis of Jack Vetriano. Still love it, art critic there. Now, at the Oscars last night, Anora, a film about a stripper and occasional sex worker who marries a wealthy Russian client, was the big winner with 5 Academy Awards.
Will you, man?
Seriously?
Seriously.
3 carrots.
What about 4?
You hit the lotto, bitch.
I know.
Bro, didn't I tell you?
Well, the story of a sex worker may be unusual subject matter for a Best Film winner, but it's not unusual for the Best Director, Sean Baker, who has explored issues around sex work and class in 2 of his earlier films, and he used a post-Oscars news conference to call for change.
It's our oldest profession, yet it has an incredible unfair stigma applied to it. And what I've been trying to do with my films is sort of I chip away at that very unfair stigma. Personally, I think it should be decriminalized. And I guess through my work, through hopefully humanizing my characters that are usually seen as perhaps caricatures in most film and television, it will help do that.
So will the success of Anora make any difference? Well, at the moment, it is legal in England, Scotland and Wales for individuals to have sex for money in private, but soliciting or working with others is illegal. Audrey Jones is a British sex worker with an alliance called Decrim Now, which is calling on the government to fully decriminalise sex work. I asked her first whether she'd enjoyed the film.
I feel there were many instances in the film that you could tell that they'd actually spoken to sex workers. For example, there was a moment where Anora told her boss that she couldn't work one day, and then he said that she had to, and then she responded that until he started paying her a 401k in health insurance, then she doesn't have to work. And that's very true to life for a lot of strippers in the UK as well as the US. I think a lot of sex workers could watch the film and have it resonate with them. That's certainly my experience and my friends' experiences of it.
And then we had the speeches last night, both from Mikey Madison, but also the director as well, saying, look, it's time to change the laws. How important is that?
It's really important that, especially for films about sex work, that sex workers are credited and thanked for that. However, I think a speech can only go so far. In the US, they have the full criminalisation of sex work. In the UK or in England, Scotland and Wales, we have a system of partial criminalisation, which means that sex workers can't work together for safety. Sex workers frequently are afraid of being arrested or cautioned, and there's a huge amount of stigma that surrounds sex work.
But just to be clear, it is not illegal to pay someone for sex or for someone to have sex for money. So sex work in itself is not illegal.
whilst selling sex is technically legal from one person to another, many of the acts surrounding that transaction are criminalised. So if a sex worker wanted to work with a friend for safety reasons, that would be classed as a brothel under the law. Sex workers who work on the street are frequently targeted by the police and given ASBOs or cautions, which when they're caught again sex working can lead to fines and arrests.
Well, in particular, the ones you've pointed to are ones that would make it safer for sex workers.
Yeah, so what my campaign group Decrim Now argues for is the full decriminalisation of sex work, which would remove all of the criminal penalties that currently target sex workers whilst keeping things like sexual exploitation illegal, which would mean that sex workers could work without fear of arrest, and sex work would also be brought under existing employment law. So sex workers, just like all other workers, could take a boss to an employment tribunal or could formally unionise against poor working conditions.
And that would counter the fears that some have, which is, if you legalise brothels, you are going to make it more likely that women are exploited.
What we've seen in New Zealand, for instance, where they already have decriminalisation, is that a worker in a brothel actually took her boss to an employment tribunal for sexual harassment and won her case. So you see that by using existing employment law, sex workers were able to challenge exploitation and create better working conditions for themselves.
And just coming back to the film, which is where we're starting from, do you think this is a moment that you can see the debate changing?
I hope that when people hear Mikey Madison saying that she is an ally to sex workers, that they will also then want to be an ally to sex workers and actually mobilise to create legislative change which would benefit the lives and the safety of sex workers in the UK.
And that was Audrey Jones, British sex worker with the Alliance Decrim Now. Let's return to the United States and have a look at one aspect of what happened in the Oval Office on Friday, because among the more memorable moments of that remarkable encounter between Presidents Trump and Zelensky and Vice President Vance was this question fired at the Ukrainian leader by one of the journalists in the room.
Why don't you wear a suit? Why don't you wear a suit? You're the highest level in this country's office and you refuse to wear a suit. Just want to see if you do own a suit.
Yeah, problems.
A lot of Americans have problems with you not
really
respecting.
I don't have such. I will wear a costume after this war will finish.
Well, the reporter who asked that question was Brian Glenn, host of the conservative cable network Real America's Voice, one of the new media organisations chosen by the White House to be part of the White House Pool. That's a group of reporters who travel with the president and report on his daily events. And last Tuesday, the White House press secretary announced a shake-up of previous arrangements under which the independent White House Correspondents Association assigned pool places to legacy media organisations and wire services. We're going to speak now to two reporters with different perspectives on those changes. S.V. Date is a senior White House correspondent at the HuffPost. He was denied entry to the White House press pool last week, although it's unclear whether HuffPost itself has been removed from the pool altogether. And Amanda Head is White House correspondent at justthenews.com. It's one of the newer conservative platforms which stands to benefit from the shake-up of the pool. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Amanda, first of all, just on that clip, do you think that was appropriate?
You know, I think for the American people who are out over $300 billion, there is a prevailing mentality that if you are coming here, you know, hat in hand, and in this situation, it was coming to come to terms on an agreement. I think that the American feel like the least you can do is show up in a suit. However, I will say this for President Zelensky, I can also understand the side of things where for his country being in conflict for, you know, 3 years and still dealing with the throes of that, I can also understand from his perspective not wanting to dress formally and feel like he should be donning the attire of what's appropriate for what's
okay.
happening.
Okay, so Sandra, you're seeing both sides of things. But let me talk to you, SV, if I can call you Shirish.
Sure.
Just tell us why, for you then, this change in the White House press pool. Well, clearly it's important for you because you've been frozen out of it, it would seem. But, I mean, why is this important, the change?
Well, it now means that President Trump is deciding which reporters will be reporting on him.
right? I mean, you had Brian Glenn, who I believe worked for RSBN, which was this Right Side Broadcasting Network, I believe. I think they live streamed. And his employer was getting money from the Trump campaign for every rally that they covered. Now, you tell me, if HuffPost were to receive a dime from anyone we covered, that would be a huge, huge scandal. And yet, you know, right-wing media does it, it looks like, pretty regularly. Now, the other thing that bothers me is that some of the reporters who are coming in now and covering these things are getting their information from Donald Trump. I mean, he says that, you know, Americans have given $300 billion. That's nowhere near accurate. Europeans have given more. And that's just one of the lies that he continues to perpetrate. And people who are invited in specifically because they're new voices are not going to call him on that.
Well, Amanda, what do you say to that?
First of all, the statement that the media should get their news from the president of the United States. Oh, my goodness. Clutch my pearls. Guess what? He is in the Oval Office and he's going to be there for another 4 years. He's going to be a newsmaker. And let's not get this twisted. This is not situation.
Are you still there, Amanda?
White House Correspondents Association. I'm still here. Can you
hear
me?
Sorry, yes. We lost your line briefly. Do continue.
Sure. The White House Correspondents Association has had a monopoly on the decision-making of the networks that are a part of the White House press room. But the larger part of this is that you have new media, you have podcasts, you have all of these organizations that do streaming media who should be included in the matrix. Because you look at organizations like Washington Post, like Huffington Post, like MSNBC, CNN, they are no longer mainstream. They are no longer the newsmakers. So you have to fold the alternative media into this. And everybody's going to get their rotation. This is not a situation where the White House is choosing not to have Huffington Post on a certain day. You are not obligated. You are not entitled to have a seat in that room every day.
Let's put that to you, Shirish, that the media is changing and these newer outlets deserve a place at the table.
Right. And the newer outlets, like HuffPost was 15 years ago, absolutely have a right to get into that room. You do it by doing the in-town rotation for a while. You do it by being accurate. You do it by being timely. You do it by being a real reporter. And the WHCA has been determining that list to make sure
the White House Correspondents Association. Sorry.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years since the Obama administration. The number of times that any administration, including Trump's previous one, has asked me for a correction on a pool report is zero. The number of times they've asked me for a correction on a story is also zero. So this is not about competence and it's not about accuracy. It's about something else. And, you know, they went right back to the rotation after leaving us out last week. So, you know, they can do what they want. He's the president. They're the White House. I'm just saying it's not great for American news consumers, nor is it good for American democracy.
Amanda, there's another question, I suppose, here, which is that some of these big legacy organizations, they've got more money. They travel everywhere. Is there a concern that if it's just the smaller ones that are perhaps don't have the funds, that you're not going to be able to cover all of the president's events? That's going to be a trickier thing. So actually, you know, the work that the White House pool does, which is to just to make sure the Americans know exactly what the president is saying and what he's doing, is going to suffer?
Certainly not. And just going back to what he was saying about accuracy, I've worked with a few Huffington Post reporters, and there have been plenty of times where corrections are mandated and, you know, they do it in the dark of the night. I work for an organization where we double and triple source everything and we don't use anonymous sources. So let's not go in the direction of journalistic integrity. But for the organizations who may not have the funds to travel along with the president, look, that's a part of the meritocracy. And if you don't have the funds to do that, then you don't get to go and you don't get to travel. But as it stands, there is a rotation and everyone who has the means to do so can be a part
of it. I did want to come back to one point that was made earlier, which is about, you know, President Trump being the source for things. I mean, it's one thing to be the source, but it's another thing not to push back when there's inaccuracies. Will you be doing that?
Yes, of course we do. We do every day.
So that's not...
There are plenty of times when President Trump has to answer a follow-up question from one of our reporters. I can't speak to Brian Glenn. I don't know every time that he has asked a follow-up question, but certainly there are follow-up questions. And those are oftentimes the times when you actually get into the nitty-gritty of the conversation. And it's very different from the Biden administration and the Obama administration, where they literally kicked out news organizations like Fox News.
Brief final word for you, Shirish. I mean, how concerned are you by this development with the White House pool?
Well, I think the one thing that's lost on this White House is that the pool works cooperatively. We help each other out. If I miss a quote, I ask the radio reporter, I ask the TV person, hey, can you play that audio back for me? And we're getting now a smaller pool and then two kind of unilateral outlets who aren't really participating in that. That's a problem.
Sure. I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We're out of time, but thank you so much. Shirish Date, Amanda Head. That is The World Tonight. From all of us here, have a very good night.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.